Welcome, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of The Law of Self-Defense. I am, of course, attorney Andrew Branca for The Law of Self-Defense, and we are back to talk about none other than Alec Baldwin again in the context of his upcoming manslaughter trial over the death of Helena Hutchins. Just waiting for YouTube to catch up here. I'm streaming on Twitter. Oh, here we go. All right. So we are here to talk about this. So the general facts, of course, Alec Baldwin was the head producer. Lead actor in the low-budget Western movie Rust, being filmed in New Mexico. He was dressed in costume, sitting in a church, preparing for a scene to be filmed. He was manipulating what he knew to be a real gun, Colt-style, single-action revolver, 45 long Colt caliber, fully capable of firing real ammo. And he was manipulating that gun on the set inside the church. Had pointed the gun directly at cinematographer Helena Hutchins, was cocking the hammer, pressing the trigger, the evidence supports, and the gun discharged a live round. That live round entered under Helena Hutchins' right armpit, passed completely through her body, breaking her spine, exited her body, entered the body of director Joel Souza, would lodge under the skin of Souza's back, where the bullet would be recovered. Helena Hutchins, of course, died of her injury. And it's been a couple of years going on, a little more than that. October 21st, 2021, I believe, was the date of the tragic event. And there was a bunch of stuff happening. About a year after the event was an initial indictment of Baldwin by an initial set of prosecutors. Those prosecutors would ultimately remove themselves from the case, be replaced by other prosecutors, Kerry Morrissey, and I forget her co-counsel's name now off the top of my head, which is not appropriate. I should remember who it is. So let's see if he signed this. Whoops. Jason something, right? Jason Lewis. Special prosecutor Jason Lewis. And that initial indictment was dismissed as well. Ultimately, Kerry Morrissey secured a new indictment on the charge of manslaughter this past January, and the case was set for trial. And Baldwin has secured a Manhattan law firm to act as his legal defense team. I think he's got 8 or 10 lawyers on the case now. There is, of course, one local New Mexico lawyer who has a good reputation as a criminal defense attorney, who's kind of just the local attorney, but obviously it's the Manhattan lawyers who are in charge. And they've submitted a lengthy motion earlier this month to have the new grand jury indictment against Baldwin dismissed for a bunch of ridiculous reasons that I covered previously in shows last week. And then Kerry Morrissey submitted a response to the defense motion to dismiss the grand jury right on target. And I covered that as well last week. In fact, in the description of today's show, I'll include links to that previous coverage. and now the state has submitted an additional filing on why they think Kerry Morrissey is a terrible person and the grand jury indictment against their client should be dismissed. Now, this newest motion by Baldwin's defense team was sent to me by a member of the Law of Self-Defense community, Mike. Mike, thank you very much. I love all of you folks, man. You make sure I don't miss anything. I do get very busy sometimes, and I don't catch all the things myself. So it's great when members of the community send me stuff. Often I will have seen it before, but sometimes I haven't. And there's no way for you to know until you send it to me and give me the heads up. So that's always greatly appreciated. So what are we going to do today is first, I'm going to step all of us through what the actual legal question is in this case. And then we're going to observe what are not relevant arguments to this case. And then we'll take a look at the Baldwin defense team's latest filing on this motion to dismiss the grand jury indictment. And I think we'll agree that it's entirely irrelevant, histrionic, ad hominem, hot garbage, which probably is the case because the defense doesn't have an actual relevant legal argument in defense of their client on the facts of this case. I believe that since October 22nd, 2021, when I wrote my first blog post on this tragic event, and everything I've learned ever since has only reinforced that perception on my part. So, and I know you love it. I have a little PowerPoint I prepared for today. That's one of the reasons I was a few minutes delayed. So, with that said, I'll go ahead and launch the formal start of today's show. Here we go. All right, today's show is brought to us, brought to you by me, by the Law of Self-Defense in the form of our best-selling book, The Law of Self-Defense Principles, your handbook to how to be hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, or your property. Check it out on Amazon. It's 5-star rated, something like 1,500 reviews, very well-received book. It's a bestseller in Amazon in its category. But don't buy it on Amazon. They'll charge you, I think it's $25 for the book, plus shipping and handling. We only ask you to cover the cost of shipping the book to you. The physical book from us is free at lawofselfdefense.com/freebook. Read the reviews on Amazon, but get the book from us. Again, lawofselfdefense.com/freebook. I'll leave the URL up there on the screen under my name here. All right, so this is what we're here to talk about today. Reply, this is from Baldwin's defense team. Reply in further support of defendant Alec Baldwin's motion to dismiss the indictment. So again, they had a very long motion that I covered last week, and then the state responded. I covered that last week as well. I'm not going to cover all that ground again to the extent I don't have to, but unfortunately, some of it I do have to. So before we jump into that, let's take a look at what are the actual relevant legal arguments here. Because until you know those, it's hard to know to what extent the defense is just throwing up smoke and mirrors and histrionics here. So, by the way, I understand and I'm sympathetic to the Baldwin defense to the extent that they are his legal defense team. He's entitled to their zealous advocacy. I often caution people, you know, a lot of people have the sentiment that, hey, if I ever get in legal trouble, I'll just hire a lawyer and he'll fix it. That's what lawyers are for, right? The trouble is that we lawyers are stuck with the facts our clients give us. If the client gives us bad facts, it's a very difficult defense. We don't have a time machine. We don't get to go back and change what you did. One of the reasons I urge you to get my book, The Law of Self-Defense Principles, at lawofselfdefense.com/freebook, because when I say it makes you hard to convict, it teaches you how to conduct yourself in self-defense so that you give good facts to your lawyer. And when you give your lawyer good facts, you make yourself genuinely hard to convict. That's our mission here at Law of Self-Defense, is to educate you and inform you on how to conduct yourself in self-defense so that you're hard to convict because you're giving your lawyer good facts. Here, Alec Baldwin has given his lawyers the worst possible facts imaginable. I mean, they're horrifically bad. since the day after this shooting, I've been calling this just a classic open and shut case of involuntary manslaughter every day of the week and twice on Sundays. And nothing's changed that assessment at all. And that's because of the facts of the case and the relevant law, New Mexico law on involuntary manslaughter by mishandling of a firearm. And once you understand what New Mexico law actually requires, you'll see why all the stuff that his defense team is talking about and complaining about and whining about is entirely irrelevant. Frankly, it strikes me as the kind of thing you'd hear like from a crazy ex-girlfriend who absolutely cannot be held accountable for bad behavior, right? So you've got this girlfriend and she sleeps with your best friend behind your back and you find out. And you're like, how could you do that? I thought we were in love. Now, are there real explanations, justifications that she might have? She might say, no, whoever's telling you that is lying to you. That never happened. Okay, well, then you'd have to evaluate the credibility of your girlfriend against those making the accusation. Maybe you believe you have absolute evidence. You stumbled in the room. She said, no, that was my twin sister. It wasn't me. I can prove. I have the passport stamps. I can prove that I was in France that weekend. And let's presume she has a twin sister. So it would be a viable excuse. But what do we always hear? We always hear avoiding accountability and irrelevant explanations. I can't believe you slept with my best friend. Well, you weren't giving me enough attention. What? You only bought me a cheap gift on my birthday. What? I was drunk. What? What? None of that matters. None of that's relevant to the misconduct. That's what I really see in all these Baldwin defense team motions. So let's jump into this. New Mexico involuntary manslaughter law. I always urge all of you when you're thinking about legal discussion and debate, especially in the criminal law, to look to the actual law. What's the actual law? Statutes, jury instructions, and case law. So let's go ahead and do that. The New Mexico statute for manslaughter is section 30-2-3. New Mexico jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter 14-231. And a bit of relevant case law here. State v. Gilliam, New Mexico Supreme Court. Excuse me, folks. It's been 4.5 weeks since I had that cold. Mm-mm-mm. Okay, let's take a look at each of these. Because this defines, the law defines the relevant legal question. The relevant legal question. Manslaughter. So statute 30-2-3, manslaughter is the unlawful killing, by which they mean, for example, unjustified, it wasn't self-defense, unlawful killing of a human being without malice. Involuntary manslaughter consists of manslaughter committed in the commission of an unlawful act, not amounting to a felony, because if it was an unlawful killing committed in the commission of an act that was a felony, it would be felony murder. That's how we differentiate this here. Manslaughter committed in the commission of an unlawful act, some other enumerated crime we can point to, not amounting to a felony, so just a misdemeanor, or in the commission of a lawful act, which might produce death. So it's an inherently dangerous act. In an unlawful manner, again, that just means like lacking justification, it wasn't self-defense, or without due caution and circumspection. So there's two ways to get to involuntary manslaughter under the New Mexico statute. In the commission of an unlawful act, the death results in the commission of an unlawful act not amounting to a felony, or in the commission of a lawful act without due care and circumspection. And of course, that's how the grand jury indictment from January of this year reads. Count one. Involuntary manslaughter, negligent use of a firearm. That's a crime. negligent use of a firearm is an independent misdemeanor under New Mexico law. So that's the first path here, right? Commission of an unlawful act. Claim count one, involuntary manslaughter, negligent use of a firearm is the predicate underlying unlawful act. That Baldwin did cause the death of Helena Hutchins in the commission of negligent use of a firearm, the predicate unlawful act, which did not amount to a felony, and that involuntary manslaughter is a fourth degree felony. Or in the alternative, because again, there's two ways to get to involuntary manslaughter. Involuntary manslaughter, this should read, it's an alternative count one. Involuntary manslaughter without due caution or circumspection. That Baldwin did cause the death of Helena Hutchins by an act committed with a total disregard or indifference for the safety of others, and the act was such that an ordinary person would anticipate that death might occur under the circumstances. That form of manslaughter is also a fourth degree felony. What is that underlying predicate misdemeanor for the first path, the unlawful act predicate? It's this statute, 30-7-4, negligent use of a deadly weapon. Negligent use of a deadly weapon consists of, and the applicable version here is, endangering the safety of another by handling or using a firearm in a negligent manner. Whoever commits negligent use of a deadly weapon is guilty of petty misdemeanor. So that's the predicate misdemeanor for the unlawful act path to involuntary manslaughter. What about the due care and circumspection path to involuntary manslaughter? Well, really, without due care and circumspection just means non-negligently. So without due care and circumspection means negligently. But if you're acting negligently in the context of handling an inherently dangerous item, the misuse of which raises a substantive and unjustified risk of death or serious bodily injury. So we're talking about heavy construction equipment. We're talking about dangerous chemicals. We're talking about explosives. We're talking about firearms. Any inherently dangerous item, the misuse of which raises a substantive and unjustified risk of death or serious bodily injury, if you do that negligently, it automatically becomes recklessness. Because what is recklessness? Recklessness is the knowing creation of an unjustified risk of death to another and ignoring that risk, just allowing it to occur. And reckless homicide is involuntary homicide if a death results. So recklessness is sufficient for criminal liability. And if you're mishandling a gun, it's always going to be recklessness. So how do we know that what Baldwin did was either negligent for negligent use of a firearm, misdemeanor, predicate misdemeanor, or that it was negligent and in the handling of a gun, criminally reckless? Well, because we have well-established rules for gun safety that Alec Baldwin has been exposed to for decades in his acting career. Dozens of films in which he's handled firearms and undergone safety training, and all that gun safety training always includes these four rules of gun safety. These are what must be followed for your handling of the gun to be non-negligent. That all guns are presumed to be loaded until the gun handler personally verifies otherwise. And that verification becomes invalid the moment the gun leaves the handler's control. Someone hands you a gun, you check it. You hand it to someone else, and they hand it right back, you check it again. Unless you've checked it, you have no idea whether or not that gun actually contains live ammo. Two, never point the muzzle of a firearm at anything you are not willing to kill or destroy. Three, never press the trigger of a firearm unless you intend for it to fire a bullet from the barrel. Four, know your target and what is beyond your target. Folks, Alec Baldwin, in his shooting of Helena Hutchins, violated every one of these gun safety laws. By the way, you can violate one and not have a bad outcome. If you don't check that the gun is free of live ammo, but that's your only mistake, the gun's pointed in a safe direction, you're not touching the trigger, well, then you don't have a bad outcome. The gun doesn't go off. If you're sure the gun doesn't have live ammo because you just checked, and then you point it at someone you're not willing to kill or destroy, you still don't have a bad outcome because there's no ammo in the gun. So it can't actually kill anybody. And you know there's no bad ammo because you just checked. If there is live ammo in the gun and you point it at someone, but you don't touch the trigger, you still don't have a bad outcome. If the gun has no live ammo and you don't point it in a dangerous direction and you press the trigger, you still don't have a bad outcome. You need to violate multiple of these safety rules to have a bad outcome. And Alec Baldwin did. Arguably, he violated all of them. He certainly did not ensure the gun had no live ammo in it because the gun had live ammo in it. We know he pointed the muzzle at a human being he was not justified in shooting because the round came out of the muzzle and directly struck Helena Hutchins. It didn't ricochet off anything. We know he pressed the trigger of the firearm. He says he didn't. But we know from mechanical testing of the firearm, it could not have discharged without the trigger being pressed. And there's other circumstantial evidence that supports that he pressed the trigger. That makes his handling of that gun negligent. That makes him in violation of New Mexico's negligent use of a deadly weapon statute, the predicate misdemeanor for involuntary manslaughter through an unlawful act. And it's also not due care and circumspection. So that path to involuntary manslaughter is also satisfied. But it's not just the four rules of gun safety. It's the Screen Actors Guild safety bulletin number one, the most important one on firearms, which, of course, Alec Baldwin has been exposed to his entire career, including the set of this movie. What does SAG say about handling guns in their safety bulletin? Refrain from pointing a firearm at anyone. Any object at which you point a firearm could be destroyed. And never place your finger on the trigger until you're ready to shoot. Did Alec Baldwin violate these two? General safe and use of firearms guidelines from the Screen Actors Guild? Obviously he did. More SAG. As an actor, you are ultimately responsible for your own safety and the safety of your fellow cast members. Production management and crew, meaning like armorers, are responsible for creating and maintaining safe conditions. But it is your right and responsibility to double check the set, and that would include props, the setup to ensure your own safety. So the fact that other people may also have been responsible for a bad outcome does not relieve the actor. Multiple people can have liability, criminal and civil, for a bad outcome. In this case, involuntary manslaughter. In fact, we know that's the case because we've already had two people found criminally liable for the death of Helena Hutchins. First, Assistant Director David Halls took a plea deal to negligent handling of a firearm. Misdemeanor, did 6 months unsupervised release. The same offer was made to armorer Helena Hutchins. She declined to take that plea. She went to trial, and she was convicted of involuntary manslaughter just last month. Alec Baldwin was also offered the David Halls plea deal, and he turned it down too. But we already know from David Halls pleading guilty, taking a plea, and Helena Hutchins being found guilty, both over the death of Helena Hutchins, that multiple people can be held criminally liable for one bad outcome. And that applies to Alec Baldwin, too. All right, so that was the statute. Now let's take a look at the New Mexico jury instruction, because the Baldwin defense team is very upset, very, very upset about how Special Prosecutor Kerry Morrissey communicated the New Mexico jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter to the grand jury. It was a travesty of justice, they say. The relevant jury instruction is 14231, and it's a very common form of jury instruction. It's largely a fill-in-the-blanks jury instruction. But it sets out what the jury, this is literally how the jury is instructed to determine whether or not Baldwin is guilty. So the standard jury instruction has fill in the blanks, and then you fill in the blanks with the name of the defendant, the appropriate alleged facts in the case. And the jury gets the filled in version, and that tells them what elements have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt for them to be justified in returning a verdict of guilty of this crime, in this particular case, involuntary manslaughter. So jury instruction 14-231, involuntary manslaughter, essential elements. For you to find the defendant guilty of involuntary manslaughter, as charged in count one of this case, the state must prove to your satisfaction beyond a reasonable doubt each of the following elements of the crime. And here I just wanted to show you the how it looks like in raw form without things filled in. So obviously fill in the blank, name of defendant. Fill in the blank, describe the defendant's act. What are the alleged lack of due care and circumspection? What was his conduct that you allege fell short of legal requirements? And most of the rest of this is just fill in name of defendant and then fill in the name of the victim and then fill in the date it happened. So when we fill all that in, what do we get? For the jury to return a verdict of guilty on manslaughter, they have to believe that the state has proven to their satisfaction beyond a reasonable doubt, one, that Baldwin discharged the firearm during the production of the movie without first verifying the firearm contained no live ammo and while the firearm was pointed in the direction of another. That's the underlying conduct that the state's alleging. That's right from what they read to the grand jury. And that's the appropriate fill in the blanks for the first element here. Two, that Baldwin should have known of the danger involved by Baldwin's actions. So he knew he was handling a real gun. He knew he was pointing a real gun at Helena Hutchins. He knew he didn't check to make sure there was no live ammo in that gun. Three, that Baldwin acted with a willful disregard for the safety of others. Again, it's basically the same element. He knew he was handling a real gun and pointing a real gun at Helena Hutchins without ensuring he had not loaded the gun. We also know he cocked the hammer and pressed the trigger. Four, that Baldwin's act caused the death of Hutchins. Well, this is beyond dispute. And this happened in New Mexico on or about the day of October 21st, 2021. Again, beyond dispute. So two things. First is, I think the evidence is incontestable that all of these elements have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, even before Baldwin's trial starts. And these are the only relevant elements, folks. This is all the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt under actual New Mexico law. The other thing is, this is the actual jury instruction. So the defense proposed an alternative jury instruction that would have required that Alec Baldwin actually knew there was a live round in the gun when he pointed it at Helena Hutchins and cocked the hammer and pressed the trigger. Folks, if he actually knew there was a live round in the gun, that would be a different crime. That would be murder. He's not charged with murder. He's charged with involuntary manslaughter. That he acted negligently in the handling of a firearm when he failed to ensure it did not contain live ammo and he pointed the gun at Helena Hutchins and he cocked the hammer and pressed the trigger. Collectively, that is the recklessness sufficient for a conviction on involuntary manslaughter. So the Baldwin desired jury instruction is that Baldwin discharged a firearm during the production of a movie and the target Baldwin should have known the danger involved from the target's action. Frankly, I think the evidence supports this jury instruction as well, but the defense is reading their own jury instruction as requiring that Baldwin was actually aware there was a live round in the gun. If that were true, we'd have a murder case here, not a manslaughter case. This is the actual New Mexico jury instruction. What the defense proposed is just something they made up. Now, does it matter how the live round got in the gun? Not according to the New Mexico Supreme Court. Does it matter that David Halls didn't adequately check? Does it matter that Hannah Gutierrez, the armorer, was the human being who apparently loaded the live round into the gun? Certainly she handed a gun with a live round onto the set. I mean, it matters for their own criminal liability. It does nothing to diminish Baldwin's criminal liability because under State v. Gilliam, New Mexico Supreme Court, quote, it could have made no difference to the trial of a charge of involuntary manslaughter as to who loaded the gun. All that is necessary to establish for involuntary manslaughter by the use of a loaded firearm is that a defendant had in his hands a gun which at some time had been loaded and that he handled it without due caution and circumspection, and that death resulted. Baldwin pointing what he knew to be a real gun at Helena Hutchins and cocking the hammer and pressing the trigger without ensuring there was not a live round in the gun obviously meets this standard. If he had had to point the gun at his own head, you think he would have personally made sure there was no live ammo in that gun? For sure, for sure. So the relevant legal question is what's stated here in the jury instruction. That Baldwin discharged a firearm during the production of the movie without first verifying the firearm contained no live ammo, and while the firearm was pointed in the direction of another, in this case, Helena Hutchins, that he should have known of the danger. He knows he's handling a real gun, that he acted with willful disregard. He pointed the muzzle at Helena Hutchins, cocked the hammer, pressed the trigger without ensuring there was no live ammo in the gun, that his act caused the death of Hutchins, and it occurred on October 21st, 2021. Both indisputable facts. This is the only relevant question and facts in this case. Let's look at what's not relevant. How first assistant director David Halls feels about the event, who he thinks was at fault or not at fault. Irrelevant is how director Joel Souza felt about the event. What's irrelevant is how props master Sarah Zachary felt about the event. You see anything in the jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter about how other people on the scene felt about the event? Really irrelevant, how producer Ryan Smith felt about the scope of Baldwin's authority as a co-producer of the film. Is that part of the jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter? Irrelevant, whether David Halls also contributed recklessly to Helena Hutchins' death, and whether armorer Hannah Gutierrez also contributed recklessly to Helena Hutchins' death. We've determined as a matter of law, they both did. They've both been found guilty in the death of Helena Hutchins. David Halls by plea, Hannah Gutierrez by conviction by a jury. But it's irrelevant to Alec Baldwin's own criminal liability. There's nothing in the jury instructions about whether other people were also reckless. Also irrelevant, how the Rust script supervisor described the event in her 911 call. She referred to it as an accident. Does that control the legal outcome in this case? That someone else felt it was an accident, described it as an accident? Also irrelevant, anything the first set of prosecutors did on this case prior to resigning from the case, because they resigned from the case. And it's irrelevant what the first indictment against Baldwin might have said or done, because that indictment's been dismissed. Whatever errors might have been committed there, the slate was wiped clean. New prosecutors were assigned, and a new grand jury indictment was secured. Also irrelevant is how much money is being spent on this prosecution. That's not part of the jury instruction. Also irrelevant, what some unsourced statements attributed anonymously to the prosecution have been published in the media. The defense claims that Carrie Morrissey has said she's trying to make this a teachable moment for Alec Baldwin. That's why she's prosecuting him. There's no evidence she ever said that. It's a completely anonymous, unsourced claim in a Hollywood media outlet. Also irrelevant, any press releases published by SAG after Baldwin's newest indictment. So in February of this year, SAG put out a press release saying, hey, you know, we know what this firearm safety bulletin number one says, but we don't feel like Alec Baldwin should be held responsible. Is that part of the jury instructions? How they felt about it? The relevant legal question is this, again, the jury instruction, the New Mexico jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter. All the rest of that nonsense is hand-waving and smoke and mirrors, and as we'll see, histrionics. And now let's get to more histrionics from this defense team. I don't think I said Hannah Reed, did I? Her name is Hannah Gutierrez. Her legal name is not Hannah Gutierrez Reed. She just added that for purposes of nepotism because her nominal father, who happens not to be her biological father, but her nominal father is Thel Reed, a famous armorer in Hollywood. Hannah's last name is Gutierrez, period. She hyphenated the Reed on so people would associate her with her nominal father. All right, let's take a look. And this was filed just 2 days ago, April 22nd, in the courtroom of Judge Mary Marlowe Summer, who, of course, was the trial judge for Hannah Gutierrez as well. Reply in further support of defendant Alec Baldwin's motion to dismiss the indictment. So remember, the defense team had filed a lengthy motion to dismiss the indictment. The state filed a response. I covered both of those last week. And now we have the defense coming back with a reply to the state's response. The local counsel is Heather LeBlanc. She's the only New Mexico attorney here. Everyone else is from Manhattan. Or if they're not from Manhattan, they work for that Manhattan law firm. They're just a satellite office. Luke Nikas, Alex Spiro, they're both partners in Quinn Emanuel, a big giant, like I think they're a top 50 law firm, maybe a top 10 law firm. Corporate law, really, civil litigation type stuff, not criminal defense. Michael Nosanchuk, I believe he's an associate in the firm. Sarah Clark in Houston, Texas, but she works for that Quinn Emanuel. I believe she's an associate as well. And there's a bunch of other attorneys also admitted pro hack vici from Quinn Emanuel for this defense. I'll skip the table of contents and jump right to the meat of things. Oh, so this is full of, I mentioned the crazy ex-girlfriend scenario analogy at the start of today's show. This motion is full of histrionics, outrage, personal offense, insults, ad hominem attacks. It starts with this quote, a quote from Anonymous. I mean, how much weight should the trial judge give a quote from Anonymous? When the debate is lost, slander becomes the tool of the loser. Signed, Anonymous. Compelling stuff, defense team. Compelling stuff. See if I can make this even a little bigger. Introduction. Alec Baldwin's motion to dismiss raises serious legal issues, makes serious legal arguments that are supported by binding legal precedents, and carries serious legal consequences, not only for Alec Baldwin, but for all New Mexico citizens. Or I guess anybody who might shoot a cinematographer in New Mexico. The motion therefore deserved a serious response addressing Baldwin's arguments about the state's misconduct in the grand jury proceeding. Instead, the state responded with a 32-page jeremiad against Baldwin and his lawyers that does not cite a single legal decision, does not distinguish Baldwin's authorities, and spends no more than 5 pages addressing the core legal issues raised in Baldwin's motion. So before I dive into this, one thing you have to understand is that all the legal arguments raised by the defense team in support of their position that the grand jury indictment should be dismissed, they're all legally irrelevant. They're all talking about facts and law that are not relevant to the criminal charge of involuntary manslaughter under New Mexico law. They claim it's relevant. They claim it's relevant to New Mexico involuntary manslaughter, but it's facially not. So they say that the state didn't respond to their legal arguments and their evidence. Well, the state doesn't have to respond to arguments and evidence that are legally irrelevant. That would be silly. That would be like going into a plumbing supply store and discovering that everything on the shelves consists of oranges and fruit and other apples. Is it really a plumbing supply store? No, obviously not. Continuing, This fact bears repeating. The state does not cite a single legal decision in its entire brief, literally. Well, it doesn't have to argue against legally irrelevant arguments or citations. A legal brief without any legal authority is not worth the paper it's written on. Unfortunately, this is no surprise for Special Prosecutor Kerry Morrissey. Prosecuting Alec Baldwin has never been about the law. It is, in her words, about using the justice system to humble an arrogant celebrity that she dislikes. This is the defense quoting that anonymous news article. There's zero evidence that Kerry Morrissey said any of this. The state's opposition to the defense motion to dismiss the grand jury should be rejected, and Baldwin's motion to dismiss the grand jury indictment should be granted. The state claims in a brief devoid of legal authority that Baldwin's motion is just an attempt to ensure that the case is not heard on its merits and to discredit the prosecution so that a conviction becomes unlikely for reasons that have nothing to do with Mr. Baldwin's criminal culpability under New Mexico law. The state has it backwards. The state's own misconduct, 2 years worth and counting, has discredited the prosecution. So they're referring here to alleged misconduct by the first set of prosecutors in securing the first indictment. All of that's irrelevant because those prosecutors resigned and that indictment was dismissed. No harm. What they're obliged to deal with now is the new prosecutors and the new indictment. And the only allegations of misconduct is that the prosecution didn't do the defense's job for it. Didn't share a bunch of irrelevant evidence and legal argument with the grand jury, which of course it's not obliged to do. Continuing, and the state's entire approach to the grand jury proceeding was designed to prevent the grand jury from hearing the case on the merits. Is that true? Just because the grand jury wasn't presented with a bunch of irrelevant evidence and legal argument doesn't mean it didn't hear the case on the merits, because irrelevant evidence and legal argument are not meritorious. The state elicited false testimony from its own experts to secure Baldwin's indictment, only to elicit the opposite testimony from the same witnesses a few weeks later at the trial of Hannah Gutierrez Reed. They made numerous statements in Gutierrez Reed's trial that contradict the premise of the state's presentation to the Baldwin grand jury. They violated the court's order on how to conduct a fair and impartial grand jury proceeding, including by refusing to contact witnesses that had information favorable to Baldwin's defense and withholding critical information from the grand jury. They read inaccurate jury instructions to the grand jury and diverted its own witness testimony and the grand jury away from the exculpatory evidence. The list goes on and on. This whole list is utter garbage, folks. So, the state elicited false testimony from its own experts, only to elicit opposite testimony from the same witnesses. This is only false testimony if you view it through the biased lens of the defense. The defense believes that if Hannah Gutierrez Reed was responsible for safety of the gun, that Baldwin could not have had any responsibility for safety with the gun. But that's not true. They're living in Delusionville. So it's not false to say that Baldwin had responsibility just because you also say that Gutierrez had responsibility. let's see. The state made numerous statements in Gutierrez's trial that contradict the premise of the state's presentation to the Baldwin grand jury. Again, this is because the defense wants to believe that if Gutierrez was criminally liable, that Baldwin could not have been. That's not the law. The state violated the court's order on how to conduct a fair and impartial grand jury proceeding. This is based on the claim by the defense that the court had ordered the state to present the grand jury with all relevant exculpatory evidence. The state did that. But the defense would like you to believe that a bunch of evidence that's not relevant should also have been presented. The court never ordered the state to do that. The court would never order the state to present irrelevant evidence to the grand jury. That wouldn't make any sense. including by refusing to contact witnesses that had information favorable to Baldwin's defense. It's favorable. Now they're talking about things like how David Halls felt Baldwin should not be held accountable, how Joel Souza felt that Baldwin should not be held accountable, how the screenwriter described the shooting as an accident to 911. That may be favorable to Baldwin on an emotional sense, but it's not legally relevant. It's not part of the jury instructions in this case. Speaking of which, the state read inaccurate jury instructions to the grand jury. That's just facially untrue. Facially untrue, as we've already discussed. And the state diverted its own witness testimony and the grand jury away from the exculpatory evidence. Again, folks, it's not enough that you describe evidence as exculpatory. It has to be relevant exculpatory evidence. In other words, it is relevant to a material factor claim in the grand jury instruction. And the defense, quote unquote, exculpatory evidence is not relevant to anything in the jury instruction for involuntary manslaughter. Continuing, and in the sludge of defamation that permeates the state's brief, their response to the motion to dismiss the indictment, Special Prosecutor Morrissey now makes the stunning admission that her decision to rescind Baldwin's plea offer and pursue an indictment had nothing to do with the facts of the case. Rather, it was based on her mistaken assumption that Baldwin commissioned a documentary film about Rust. Actually, Morrissey had several grounds for rescinding the plea offer she made to Baldwin. The big one, you notice the defense doesn't mention here, is that the defense discussed the plea motion publicly with the media. Well, there's an obligation of confidentiality when plea negotiations are taking place. And if the defense violates that duty of confidentiality, the state's perfectly within its authority to withdraw the plea offer, which is what happened here. Continuing, the state violated the U.S. and New Mexico constitutions. That's arguably true, but that would have been the first prosecutors in the first indictment, which has been dismissed, so it's irrelevant. Violated the rules of ethics and the most basic prosecutorial norms. Well, who's to say what the norms are in New Mexico criminal court? New Mexico prosecutors or Manhattan civil litigation attorneys? Violated the laws that apply to grand jury proceedings in New Mexico. That's just not true. Violated the court's orders. Just not true. Misled grand jurors and the grand jury judge. Just not true. And elicited false testimony from its witnesses. Again, not true. But the false testimony claim is, again, the defense position that if Gutierrez was criminally liable, Baldwin cannot have been. That's not the law. All this other stuff is the defense complaining that this giant pool of favorable exculpatory evidence that we wanted presented to the grand jury was not presented to the grand jury. Well, it only needs to be presented if it's relevant, and it wasn't. And indeed, it doesn't need to be presented. The state has no obligation to present the defense argument to the grand jury and evidence. They need to make it available to the grand jury. They need to make the grand jury aware that it's available for their consideration. And the state did that here. All right, next section, argument. The state fails to address the majority of the arguments raised in Baldwin's motion for the good reason that those arguments are irrelevant. The state's not obligated to rebut irrelevant legal arguments by the defense. Baldwin moved to dismiss the indictment based on several grounds, including the state's intentional misleading of grand jurors, which prevented them from considering evidence they were legally required to consider. Well, they're not. They're only legally required to consider relevant evidence. And its manipulation of the grand jury process in violation of the court's orders and New Mexico law. The relief Baldwin seeks is firmly grounded in New Mexico law and supported by binding judicial precedent. Let's see what it says here. Requiring prosecutors to act in a fair and impartial manner at all times during grand jury proceedings. That doesn't mean that they're the puppet of the defense, that they have to conduct themselves in the way the defense wants them to conduct themselves. Another citation. It is the duty of the grand jury to weigh all the evidence submitted to it, and when it has reason to believe that other lawful, competent, and relevant evidence is available that would disprove or reduce a charge or accusation, or that would make an indictment unjustified, then it shall order the evidence produced. What's the key word there, folks? Relevant. Relevant. The defense wants to pretend that how David Halls feels emotionally about Baldwin's liability is what should be legally binding here, is relevant to the legal issue in this case on involuntary manslaughter. It is not. Another citation. Dismissing indictment where the prosecutor prevented grand jury from inquiring into the facts, demonstrating probable cause, and failed to act in a fair and impartial manner when instructing the grand jury. So the defense thinks that fair and impartial would require the state to give the defense-crafted jury instruction to the grand jury rather than the actual New Mexico jury instruction. Another citation, when serving as an aide to the grand jury, a prosecuting attorney must facilitate the grand jury's inquiry into any lawful, relevant, and competent evidence not initially presented by the state and cannot unilaterally withhold evidence or witnesses requested by the grand jury. Here it says facilitate. In other words, make available to the grand jury, not present, not argue the defense side to the grand jury. And it says they cannot withhold evidence or witnesses requested by the grand jury. But what did the grand jury request that they withheld? The grand jury was told all witnesses were available to them. And they were given boxes of defense evidence and told, you're free to look at this. This is proffered by the defense. They didn't want to. Another citation, dismissing indictment where prosecutor failed to elicit exculpatory testimony that contradicted testimony from prosecution's law enforcement witness. There's nothing like that here. Excuse me. They make all these arguments, the defense does, in the general. And then when you get to the specific facts they claim support their arguments, there's no there. There's no substance. Continuing, the state does not devote a single paragraph of its 32-page response to addressing any of the cases or principles cited above and throughout Baldwin's motion. Again, the state's not obligated to rebut irrelevant evidence and legal arguments. The state does not attempt to distinguish those cases by their facts or explain why it shouldn't be bound by the holdings of those cases. It's like when you're having an argument with someone and they just want to keep moving the goalposts and changing the subject. That's what the defense is doing here. The topic is very well defined. It's in this jury instruction. This is the relevant question, legal question in this case, not stuff the defense just happens to want to talk about. Nor does the state offer any authorities to support its conduct. Instead, the state's response to Baldwin's motion consists almost entirely of irrelevant, false, unsupported, and highly prejudicial statements that serve no legitimate purpose. Talk about the kettle calling the pot black. Or is it the pot calling the kettle black? That's pretty rich, defense. Mirror, mirror. The state begins its response with a purported recitation of the factual and procedural history of the case as we know it. What follows is a 22-page missive attacking Baldwin and his attorneys, not a single sentence of which is relevant to the legal issues raised on this motion, and much of which is false. Well, it is. Much of it was not relevant to the legal issues in the case because it was being responsive to the irrelevant arguments made in the defense motion to dismiss the grand jury indictment. Let's see. I'll skip the little details here because they concede it was irrelevant, so there's no point talking about it. Continuing, these statements from the state and several others like them throughout the state's response have nothing to do with the issues raised in Baldwin's motion and are clearly intended to prejudice potential jurors, tarnish Baldwin before your honor, and deflect from the fact that the state cannot cite a single legal authority to support its arguments. It has the authority. It has the jury instruction. That's it. That's all the authority it needs. And the facts to support that jury instruction. At least to the point of probable cause, which is what's required to uphold the indictment. The state's failure to distinguish Baldwin's authorities or offer a legal authority of its own constitutes a waiver. Okay, so the state has waived argument against the defense irrelevant evidence and legal arguments. Congratulations, defense. I guess you won on the irrelevant stuff. As explained below, when the state does attempt to address a small handful of Baldwin's arguments, meaning the relevant ones, it does so by mischaracterizing Baldwin's position and then responding with a mix of irrelevant and inaccurate assertions that contain no legal support. Again, they say these things in the general, but where's the specifics? Baldwin's motion to dismiss shall be granted for these reasons alone. Two, the state concedes that it violated the court's order and New Mexico law. It does it, though? Does it? Let's see. The state ensured that the grand jury would have no access to Baldwin's exculpatory witnesses or exculpatory evidence. What's missing from that heading, folks? What word? Relevant. The state's only obligated to present relevant witnesses and relevant evidence to the grand jury. Not anything that the defense feels is exculpatory. Baldwin's grand jury alert letter. So this is a letter written by the defense that's to be shared with the grand jury. It alerts them to the defense position on the criminal charges and evidence and witnesses the defense believes the grand jury should hear. It doesn't make them automatically relevant to the criminal charge or the jury instruction. So this grand jury alert letter was prepared by the defense, sent to Prosecutor Morrissey, and she gave a copy, a physical copy of that letter to every grand jury and read it to them aloud, every word of it. That doesn't mean the grand jury has to hear those witnesses listed in the alert letter or look at any particular claims of evidence in the alert letter. Baldwin's grand jury alert letter identified more than a half dozen witnesses who had information favorable to his defense. That's, again, David Hall's feels that Alec Baldwin should not be held criminally liable. That's favorable to Baldwin, but is that legally relevant? No. As well as numerous exculpatory documents. But again, it doesn't say relevant exculpatory documents. Baldwin also made a separate submission to the grand jury judge that listed numerous questions that should be asked of witnesses to elicit exculpatory evidence. Again, we don't have relevant here, and the grand jury is not obliged to ask questions submitted by the defense. The grand jury has its own authority to decide what it thinks are relevant questions. The state refused to present nearly any of the exculpatory documents. Well, that's probably true. But the state doesn't have an obligation to present things just because the defense wants it presented. The state has an obligation to facilitate the grand jury having access to those materials and not withholding those materials from the grand jury. And the state made all of those available to the grand jury, told the grand jury what they were, said, you have subpoena power. If you want any of these witnesses to come in here, if you want to review any of these documents, here they are. That's all the state's obligated to do. The state is not obligated to make a presentation of the defense argument to the grand jury. That's not how grand juries work. That's what a trial is for. The trial is the genuinely adversarial process. The state refused to present nearly any of the exculpatory documents. Again, doesn't say relevant. Objected to presenting testimony from all but one of the proposed defense witnesses. And refused to pose the questions that Baldwin listed. Again, no obligation to do that. Following a hearing on this dispute, the grand jury court ordered the state to alert grand jurors to the existence of all of Baldwin's witnesses and their potential testimony. Okay, so did the grand jury then do that? I'm sorry, did the state then do that? Yes. The court then ordered the state to make these witnesses readily available to avoid scheduling disruptions if the grand jury wishes to hear from them. Well, they were. The grand jury was told you can have any of these witnesses come in here and testify and answer your questions. And the grand jury asked for none of them. The court's order was issued in accordance with binding New Mexico law. Well, presumably so. As explained in Baldwin's motion, the state violated the court's order. The state did not make the witnesses readily available. Well, this is just a subjective judgment call by the defense, right? What they wanted, what, all the witnesses to be flown in and kept in the hallway outside the grand jury room just in case the grand jury wanted to hear from them? That wasn't in the judge's order. Readily available means informing the grand jury that if you want to hear from these witnesses, we will make them available to you. Continuing, the state also violated New Mexico law because it failed to present any of the exculpatory evidence from those witnesses or the documents Baldwin identified. Again, the missing magic word, relevant exculpatory evidence is what's required. The state responds that it followed Judge Ellington's order to the letter because it presented Baldwin's alert letter verbally and in writing to every grand juror in the room. But the state does not deny that it refused to contact Baldwin's witnesses before the grand jury proceeding. Well, it had no obligation to do that. That wasn't in the court's order. The court didn't say, state, you have to contact Baldwin's witnesses before the grand jury proceeding. Nor does it dispute that it failed to present the exculpatory evidence identified in Baldwin's alert letter. It's not required to present any evidence the defense wants that the defense claims is exculpatory, especially if it's not relevant evidence. Continuing, instead, Morrissey essentially claims that she was free to ignore the court's order. Look how they have to use the word essentially here. Does Morrissey claim this? Does Morrissey actually claim I'm free to ignore the court's order? No, of course not. This is a representation of the defense of Morrissey's conduct. Instead, Morrissey essentially claims that she was free to ignore the court's order because the grand jury did not elect to hear from Mr. Baldwin's witnesses and therefore no scheduling disruptions were encountered. At the same time, the state seeks to reassure the court that if the grand jury had elected to hear from Baldwin's witnesses, they would have been presented in person. Virtually, after seeking and obtaining approval from the court or via recorded statements they previously provided to law enforcement and pretrial interviews. Everything about that response is appalling, the defense says. First, it is incorrect that the availability of the witnesses did not matter. The state's claim that the grand jury had no interest in requesting the attendance of Baldwin's witnesses even after it was alerted to their existence is false. As Baldwin's motion demonstrates, the grand jury expressed significant interest in Baldwin's witnesses, especially Halls and Zachary, on numerous occasions. So David Halls, first assistant director, pled guilty to a misdemeanor in the death of Elena Hutchins. Sarah Zachary, she signed on to a cooperation agreement with the state in lieu of prosecution. She was the props master. Neither of them has anything to say that is legally relevant to this question, the jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter. Neither of them. So even if the grand jury had requested to hear from David Halls and Sarah Zachary, there was no relevant evidence or testimony either of them could provide. Therefore, their attendance would be irrelevant, and the request for them is irrelevant, legally irrelevant, to the legal question in this case. Continuing, yet each time a grand juror began making inquiries about Halls or Zachary, or inquiries that only Halls or Zachary were qualified to answer, and those answers could only have been legally irrelevant, the state would firmly escort them in a different direction, back to relevancy, redirect the inquiry to a different witness who was unqualified to answer, or rephrase the inquiry to match the evidence the state wanted the grand jury to hear and exclude the exculpatory evidence it didn't. Well, again, there's no obligation to present exculpatory evidence that's not relevant to the legal question before the grand jury. The state's approach violated both the court's order, and the state's separate obligation to facilitate the grand jury's understanding of its role and the evidence and witnesses that were available to it. Again, all of this would have to be relevant, and it's not. The state cannot hide that ball and watch as grand jurors meander through the dark in hopes that they won't stumble upon a witness the state was ordered to make available, especially when the grand jury tapes make clear that grand jurors were clueless as to the significance of Baldwin's alert letter. Well, what's this clueless? What's that mean? By the way, how could it could have been made certain that the grand jurors were fully informed as to the significance of Baldwin's alert letter? Well, the defense that wrote the alert letter could have begun it with a paragraph that said, "Dear grand jurors, the significance of this alert letter to your role on this grand jury is as follows." Did they do that? And if they didn't bother doing that, why would it be the obligation of the state? Continuing, instead of taking responsibility for its role as an aid to the grand jury and its obligation to facilitate the grand jury's inquiries into exculpatory evidence, again, no relevant here, the state also seeks to divert blame to the grand jury judge for failing to keep grand jurors informed, citing the court's obligation to notify grand jurors of their ability to subpoena witnesses. But that is irrelevant. There was no need for the grand jury to issue subpoenas to hear from Baldwin's witnesses because the state was ordered to secure their availability in advance. Well, there's no indication that any of the witnesses were unsecured. Second, even if it were true that the grand jurors had no interest in this exculpatory evidence, again, no relevant here, that would not justify the state's violation of the court's orders or New Mexico law requiring that the exculpatory evidence be presented. There was no order that it be presented. It had to be made available to the grand jury, and even then, only if it's legally relevant. This would also constitute an unjustified derogation of the grand jury's duty to order that exculpatory information, if it's relevant, be produced for its consideration. The evidence was, it was sitting in bankers' boxes in the grand jury room. They were aware of it. They had every opportunity to look at it. Thus, according to Morrissey's own assessment of the situation, she either stood idly by while the grand jury violated its duty to order that exculpatory evidence be produced, again, only true of its relevant exculpatory evidence, or she crafted the grand jury process such that she would refuse to present the exculpatory evidence and would ensure that the grand jury did not understand it had the independent right and obligations to order the evidence produced. Produced and presented are two different things. First, the evidence has to be relevant. If it's irrelevant, it doesn't matter. If it is relevant, it needs to be produced. And it was produced. It was made available to the grand juries. It need not be presented by the state. Either way, the indictment was procured in violation of New Mexico law. Now, finally, the state's half-hearted claim that Baldwin's witnesses would have been presented if the grand jury wanted to hear from them and they were relevant cannot be taken seriously. The state concedes that it could not have secured the physical presence of the witnesses since it references virtual testimony and pre-recorded statements. Nothing in Judge Ellington's order permitted the state to present Baldwin's witnesses virtually, but nothing prohibited it either, folks. So it's permissible. The most common thing in the world today is court proceedings taking place virtually, even into trial courts. Nothing in Judge Ellington's order permitted the state to present Baldwin's witnesses virtually, nor are unsworn video recorded statements and pretrial interviews a substitute for grand jury testimony or the additional testimony described in Baldwin's briefing that the court said should be elicited. Well, no. The court didn't say it should be elicited. Only relevant information needs to be elicited. I've yet to see the defense point to any any evidence that's actually relevant to the legal question in this case, which is New Mexico jury instruction 14-231, involuntary manslaughter, essential elements. Nothing David Halls, Joel Souza, Sarah Zachary has to say about this event has any relevance to this jury instruction. Further, no video recorded statements or pretrial interviews even exist for several of Baldwin's witnesses. So they would have had to be zoomed in or come in personally. Including one of the state's own investigators who was so appalled by the incompetence of the state's investigation that he said it was reprehensible and unprofessional to a degree I still have no words for and could not be remedied. So this is a guy who quit in a funk. He was a contract employee. He learned his contract was not going to be renewed, so he quit in a funk and said mean things about the investigation. Does he have any relevant evidence contrary to the actual relevant legal question in this case, that investigator? Any relevant exculpatory evidence? Any evidence of misconduct in the investigation that's relevant to this legal question? No, he does not. He does not. In the Hannah Gutierrez trial, the defense made lots of argument about shortcomings in the investigation, errors that were made by investigators, and a lot of that was true. But none of it touched on any material fact in the case, a fact that would have changed a finding of guilt or not guilt. So, for example, one criticism was that the police, when they secured the revolver in question, weren't wearing gloves. Well, that could have smudged fingerprints, or it could have added their own fingerprints or DNA or whatever. And that's true. They did that wrong. You should be wearing gloves when you pick up the weapon. But it's immaterial because it's uncontested who was holding the gun when it discharged. So it doesn't matter what fingerprints are on the gun. It doesn't matter what DNA is on the gun. Sure, it was a defect in the investigation, but it doesn't touch on any material fact. In short, the state was required to present exculpatory evidence to the grand jury, but it failed to do so. No, it's not required to present. It's required to make available. And even then, only relevant exculpatory evidence, meaning relevant to the actual legal question in the case, which is that jury instruction. And the court ordered the state to make Baldwin's witnesses, quote unquote, readily available. They have to put readily available in scare quotes because there is no concrete definition of that. And the grand jury never asked to hear from those witnesses, so it was never put to the test. But the state ignored the order. No, the state will say, we would have made them available, either in person or by Zoom or by prior statements they've made. As a result, the grand jurors, but it's all irrelevant. It's all immaterial because the grand jury never asked for any of these witnesses. As a result, the grand jurors were denied the opportunity to consider substantial exculpatory evidence, again, no word relevant there, that could easily have led to a decision not to indict Baldwin. Not a rational decision. The state's conduct, as described above and in further detail in Baldwin's motion, constitutes bad faith that subjects the indictment to judicial review and requires dismissal. Well, it's being judicially reviewed. That's what these motions are about. It certainly does not require dismissal just because you say so. Next section. The state intentionally questioned its witnesses to elicit false testimony and avoid the disclosure of exculpatory information. Again, what we'll see in this false testimony is that in the Gutierrez trial, they said Gutierrez was criminally liable, was responsible for safety. And now to the grand jury, they said Alec Baldwin was responsible for safety. And that's what the defense here is characterizing as false testimony. The grand jury testimony saying Baldwin was responsible for safety because after all, in the trial, they said Gutierrez was responsible for safety. How about this, defense? How about everybody? Everybody is responsible for safety. After all, what does SAG say? As an actor, you are ultimately responsible for your own safety and the safety of your fellow cast members. Production management and crew are responsible for creating and maintaining safe conditions, but it is your right and responsibility to double-check the setup to ensure your own safety. And what about this? Refrain from pointing a firearm at anyone, including yourself. Who was pointing the firearm that killed Helena Hutchins? Never place your finger on the trigger until you're ready to shoot. Who was placing their finger on the trigger when that gun discharged and killed Helena Hutchins? Hannah Gutierrez? David Halls? Only one person can be responsible for these faults, and that is Alec Baldwin. Again, is it possible for multiple people to have criminal liability for the death of Helena Hutchins? Clearly, both David Halls and Hannah Gutierrez have already been found criminally liable for her death. And Alec Baldwin is about to be added to the list. All right. In addition to the state's unlawful refusal to present exculpatory evidence to the grand jury, the special prosecutors also questioned their own witnesses in a manner that violated the court's order and New Mexico law. The state was required to present witnesses in a fair and impartial manner at all times during the grand jury proceedings. Among other requirements, the state was prohibited from intentionally questioning the witness in a manner intended to keep the witness from providing the grand jury with information that the target wanted before the grand jury, the target meaning Baldwin. It has to be relevant information, folks, relevant to the actual legal question. The state intentionally violated that bedrock rule, which ensures the grand jury's independence from the prosecutor. For example, the state's questioning of Detective Alexandria Hancock steered clear of the exculpatory information she possessed. What was this exactly? What is this specifically, this exculpatory information that Detective Hancock possessed? Again, has to be relevant. Hancock's investigation into the accident uncovered a flood of information favorable to Baldwin's defense. But Morrissey elicited virtually none of it. She didn't elicit, for example, that Hancock learned it was the responsibility of Gutierrez and Halls to ensure the gun was safe to handle, and that Halls admittedly failed to properly inspect the gun before handing it to Baldwin. See, folks? See what they're doing? They're saying, hey, it may have been Gutierrez and Halls who were responsible, but that means Baldwin could not have been responsible. If they were responsible, he was not. Does that make any logical reason to any of you? Is that what New Mexico law requires? No. All of them can be criminally liable, which means that the liability of Halls and Gutierrez is legally irrelevant to the liability of Baldwin and therefore need not be presented to the grand jury. Continuing, instead, Hancock told grand jurors that Gutierrez told her she opened up the cylinder of that revolver, showed Dave Halls what was inside that cylinder, spun it, and then gave it to him, omitting Halls' highly exculpatory admission that when Hannah showed him the firearm before continuing rehearsal, he could only remember seeing three rounds and that he should have checked all of them, but didn't, and couldn't recall if she spun the drum. Great. That's evidence of the criminal liability of Gutierrez and Halls. And it's completely irrelevant to the independent criminal liability of Alec Baldwin for pointing that muzzle at Helena Hutchins, cocking the hammer and pressing the trigger. Gutierrez and Halls had nothing to do with that conduct. Nor did Morrissey elicit the fact that Hancock was told by another witness that Baldwin had been very careful in handling the gun on set. Well, let's pretend that he had been very careful in handling the gun on set on previous occasions. That's not the legal question. The legal question was he being adequately careful, due care and circumspection, non-negligent in his handling of the gun when it discharged and killed Helena Hutchins? Patently not. So however safe he may have been on previous occasions is irrelevant to the legal question in this case. Continuing, the state's questioning of Brian Carpenter, he was an armorer expert witness for the state in the Gutierrez trial, and I guess at the grand jury for Baldwin. The state's questioning of Brian Carpenter, one of its paid expert witnesses, was even more egregious. Not only did Carpenter pad his credentials to expand the scope of his purported expertise, this is just a misrepresentation. He said he was doing less armorer work these days and trying to get into producing films. He didn't make much of his production expertise, and it was, in any case, be irrelevant to this case. He pad his credentials to expand the scope of his purported expertise, but the state elicited his false testimony that it was Baldwin's responsibility to ensure the safety of the firearm. Is that false? What does SAG have to say about that? As an actor, you are ultimately responsible for your own safety and the safety of your fellow cast members. Refrain from pointing a firearm at anyone, including yourself. That can only apply to Baldwin on the facts of this case. Never place your finger on the trigger until you're ready to shoot. That can only apply to Baldwin on the facts of this case. So is it false to say it was Baldwin's responsibility to ensure the safety of the firearm? I think not. Morrissey knew this was incorrect and yet elicited the statement from Carpenter anyway. Indeed, just a few weeks after the grand jury proceeding at the trial of Hannah Gutierrez, Morrissey elicited the exact opposite testimony from Carpenter. At Gutierrez's trial, Carpenter testified it was the responsibility of Gutierrez and Halls, not the actor, to check and clear the gun, that it is rare for actors to do that, and that as long as you've done your safety check with at least two other sources and moved through that process, then you've done what you should have done. Assuming everything goes right, assuming that stuff happened, but if that previous safety checks didn't happen adequately, once the gun comes into your hand, it's your responsibility. Again, the fact that Gutierrez and Halls were criminally liable is irrelevant to Baldwin's criminal liability. The state's improper jury instruction, which mirrors Carpenter's untruthful testimony, magnified the harm of this false testimony. This is all nonsense. The jury instruction was proper. It was the standard New Mexico jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter. Carpenter's testimony is not untruthful, and there was no false testimony. The state does not address these issues anywhere in its 32-page response because they're smoke and mirrors. There's nothing to address on the merits. Of course, there isn't much one can say when the theory underpinning the case against Baldwin contradicts the theory underpinning the jury verdict the state just obtained against Gutierrez. Again, the defense is arguing, hey, if you held Gutierrez responsible, that means you can't hold Baldwin responsible. That's not the law. The grand jury judge specifically warned the state that if its questioning runs afoul of the standards described above, it would entitle Baldwin to post-indictment review of the grand jury proceedings to evaluate the fairness of the prosecution's actions. Yeah, except despite the defense claims here, the state's questioning does not run afoul of the required standards. The state disregarded the court's order, disregarded New Mexico law, presented testimony it knew was false, presented testimony and evidence to the grand jury that contradicted the testimony it presented before Your Honor in the Gutierrez trial, and withheld exculpatory evidence from the grand jury. All of that is smoke and mirrors. The indictment should also be dismissed on these independent grounds. Next section, C. The state's attempt to disclaim responsibility for its failures are unavailing. On the few occasions where the state does purport to address Baldwin's arguments, it does so by responding to misconstrued assertions that Baldwin never made. For example, the state claims that Baldwin's primary complaint about the state's grand jury presentation is that it was too short. Not even close. As Baldwin's motion made clear, the state's presentation violated the court's orders. Nope. And failed to comply with New Mexico law. Nope. In numerous ways that have nothing to do with the length of the proceeding. Baldwin's point about the schedule for the grand jury proceeding is that Morrissey proceeded with the presentation, even though she knew it would be impossible to present the significant exculpatory evidence that existed in the short time remaining in the grand jury's term. Yeah, the defense wanted to present a ton of exculpatory evidence to the grand jury. There would not have been time for that. Unfortunately for the defense, all their quote-unquote exculpatory evidence was irrelevant. It was things like how David Halls felt about the event, how Sarah Zachary felt about the event, how Joel Souza felt about the event. None of that is relevant to the legal question here. The state responds to this observation by claiming that its grand jury presentation was one of the longest in New Mexico history. It is impossible to know whether this is true, but it doesn't matter because it's irrelevant. Then why are we talking about it? The point is that the state charged headlong. This is just, histrionic language. Did they charge headlong? It's just imagery, right? Into the grand jury proceeding, knowing that it would not be able to present the required exculpatory evidence, not required if it's irrelevant. Yet another fact demonstrating the state's bad faith. The state's brag, again, the state simply made an observation that it had spent a lot more time on a fourth-degree misdemeanor charge than prosecutors typically spend before a grand jury on a capital murder charge. The state's brag, the claim to have conducted one of the longest grand jury presentations in New Mexico history, actually shows how disturbing this prosecution has become. Again, disturbing is just histrionic language. The state's admission that it supposedly spent an unprecedented amount of time presenting Baldwin's fourth-degree felony case to the grand jury, even though it skipped over all the exculpatory evidence, shows only one thing. The state has invested an unprecedented level of commitment toward prosecuting Alec Baldwin. So if the state spends too much time in front of the grand jury, the defense doesn't like that. That's objectionable. They're working too hard to indict our client. But if they had done it, the other complaint the defense has is, oh my God, the state never would have had time to present all this evidence. Well, pick one. If capital murder cases are routinely presented to a grand jury in under 3 hours, as the state claims, yet it took the state a day and a half to present its case against Baldwin, the only plausible inference to be drawn is that the state's agenda against Baldwin is wildly out of control. More histrionic language. Similarly, the state claims that Baldwin demonstrated his ignorance of the rules of evidence as they pertain to grand jury proceedings by criticizing the state for presenting its investigator, Connor Rice, to testify as to hearsay related to the investigation and the incident. But Baldwin never argued that hearsay was inadmissible in a grand jury proceeding. It is, in fact, admissible, folks. Hearsay evidence is admissible to a grand jury, not a petite jury, not a trial jury. Unless an exception is found. The word hearsay appears nowhere in Baldwin's opening brief. What Baldwin argued is that it was inappropriate to present Rice, a paid private investigator, to testify about the firsthand knowledge of witnesses the state was obligated to but didn't make available. Again, all these witnesses, first of all, they didn't have any relevant testimony to offer. Second of all, the grand jury was told they could have access to those witnesses if they wanted. They didn't want. And that this was especially problematic because Rice both failed to present the exculpatory evidence that should have been elicited from those witnesses and demonstrated extremely limited knowledge of the relevant facts. The state's misdirection appears in other places as well. For example, Baldwin's motion observed that the state's improper attempt to shorten his time to submit a grand jury alert letter further evidenced the state's bad faith an intent to manipulate the grand jury process. Well, I think the state may have done that, but the defense objected and the court sustained the objection, so this never actually happened. So it's a moot point. In response, the state simply repeats and incorporates the arguments made in its original motion to the grand jury judge. Not only did the grand jury judge reject those arguments at the time, but it is now clear that even those arguments were made in bad faith. Specifically, the state represented to the court that it needed to shorten Baldwin's time to submit an alert letter so it could have additional time, 6 days, to make travel plans and accommodations for any additional witnesses it was ordered to make available to the grand jury. Again, none of this actually happened, so it's all moot. Yet when the state was ultimately given a full week to make travel plans and accommodations for the additional witnesses the court ordered the state to make available, it didn't bother to contact any of them. Well, the grand jury didn't ask for any of them. The state dodged all of Baldwin's legal authorities and nearly all of his substantive arguments. And on the rare occasion when the state did engage on the issues, irrelevant issues, it set up and struck down strawman arguments that bore little or no resemblance to Baldwin's actual position. The court should therefore reject each of the state's responses to Baldwin's motion to dismiss. Three, the state issued an improper jury instruction. That would be, of course, this jury instruction, the actual standard New Mexico jury instruction for involuntary manslaughter, with the blanks filled in for the facts of this case. As demonstrated in Baldwin's motion, the import of the state's jury instruction. So the import, this is like when they said that Carrie Morrissey essentially did something. Did she actually do that thing? No. So they have to use that conditional word essentially to make it feel as if she did something. Here, the state's jury instruction did not do what the defense says it did, but the import of it is something the defense finds objectionable. As demonstrated in Baldwin's motion, the import of the state's jury instruction was that probable cause existed to indict Baldwin for involuntary manslaughter if he discharged a firearm during the production of the movie without first verifying the firearm contained no live ammunition and while the firearm was pointed in the direction of another, and if he should have known of the danger involved from those actions. Okay? That is the lack of due care and circumspection. That is the negligent handling of a firearm. Those facts. By the way, indisputable facts. The defense here claims that instruction violates New Mexico law. The state effectively, again, in other words, did the state actually do this? No. The defense wants you to feel like the state did this. The state effectively instructed the grand jury that Baldwin had a duty to check the firearm for live ammunition and to refrain from pointing it at anyone. Actually, he had the duty to not do those collective acts. If you're going to point a gun at someone, make sure there's no live ammo in the gun. If you're not going to make sure there's no live ammo in the gun, don't point it at someone. It's the collective violation of the safety rules that resulted in this bad outcome that constitutes involuntary manslaughter. But those are precisely the questions that the grand jury was supposed to decide for itself based on the evidence, not based on immutable instructions of law. Once grand jurors were told that Baldwin had such a legal duty and didn't obey it, what was left for the grand jury to decide? Well, yes, the alleged negligent conduct, the facts are presented to the grand jury. They decide if it's negligent or lack of due care and circumspection. And by the way, as a matter of law, it is. As a matter of law, if you violate those rules against safety under New Mexico law, as we saw, that is negligent handling of a firearm. That's the predicate criminal misdemeanor for involuntary manslaughter. It's also lack of due care and circumspection, which is the negligence that combined with handling an inherently dangerous instrument like a firearm escalates to recklessness that is sufficient for criminal liability. The state argues that it did not deviate from UJI 14231. It simply filled in the language that was required to be filled in and did so in accordance with the instruction and the facts presented to the grand jury. Again, folks, here's the jury instruction in raw form, the blanks. Name of the defendant, describe defendant's act, name of the victim, date it happened. What did the state present to the grand jury? It filled in the blanks exactly as it's supposed to. To justify the way the state filled in the language on the uniform jury instruction form, the state argues that the reason Baldwin's behavior was a violation of the law is because he pointed a gun at a person, cocked it, and pulled the trigger, having no personal knowledge what type of ammunition was in the gun. Right. It further argues that Baldwin had a duty to confirm that only inert ammunition had been placed in the gun before pointing it at a person, cocking it, and pulling the trigger as a gun handler in the state of New Mexico, subject to New Mexico laws, and his failure to do so resulted in negligent homicide as long as the other elements of the crime are satisfied. Those are fictitious statements of law that the prosecutors fabricated out of whole cloth without citing a single legal authority to support them. Nope, that's just not true. The general doctrines of the mental states of negligence and recklessness are universal across criminal statutes. Instead of citing law to support its legal position, the state claims that the legal instruction was appropriate because of the facts presented to the grand jury. By the way, the uniform jury instruction is presumptively the correct law. That's why it's a uniform jury instruction. So instead of citing law to support its legal position, the state claims that the legal instruction was appropriate because of the facts presented to the grand jury. To begin with, this is a non sequitur. The state cannot create a legal standard using facts. The legal standard is what it is, and the facts then tell us how the legal standard applies in the circumstances. Let's see. Moreover, the state further prejudiced the grand jury with this approach because the grand jury hadn't been presented with any facts when the state first read the instruction, which primed the grand jury to view the evidence through the state's unsupported legal theory. The legal theory of negligent handling of a firearm and reckless homicide with a firearm are not bizarrely the state's unsupported legal theory. They are the law. And there's nothing wrong with the grand jury being told, listen, at the end, we're going to ask you if the evidence presented establishes probable cause that the elements of this jury instruction have been satisfied to your satisfaction. So we're going to read that jury instruction to you now so that as you hear the evidence, you can filter it through understanding where you need to end up, what your final consideration will be. Perfectly appropriate to do that. You want to do that. Otherwise, the grand jury is hearing all this evidence in a vacuum. They don't know what to listen for. They don't know when they're hearing something relevant and important or exculpatory. The state's effort to avoid the law by wrapping itself in the facts presented to the grand jury also collapses for two additional reasons. The state not only failed to present numerous exculpatory facts to the grand jury, again, they don't have the word relevant here, right? Again, they're talking about how David Halls, Sarah Zachary, Joel Souza emotionally felt about the event and whether Alec Baldwin's legally liable. You can call that exculpatory if you want, but it's not relevant to the legal question. The state not only failed to present numerous exculpatory facts to the grand jury in violation of New Mexico law, but the state's grand jury instruction also contradicts its own statements and expert testimony at Gutierrez's trial. So again, they're circling back to this ridiculous argument that if the state argued Gutierrez had criminal liability, they cannot also argue that Baldwin had criminal liability. That's not the law. Both of them can have criminal liability in their own way. Hannah Gutierrez for handing a hot gun onto a movie set, Alec Baldwin for pointing the muzzle at Helena Hutchins, cocking the hammer, and pulling the trigger. Continuing, for example, the following are just some of Prosecutor Morrissey's statements at the Gutierrez trial. If you think the intervening event is that Baldwin manipulated the gun, that's the whole purpose of the prop. He's going to manipulate it. You saw a bunch of other actors do it. You, Gutierrez, don't escape accountability when you load a live round into a prop gun, tell the crew that it has dummy rounds in it, hand it off to an actor, and leave the room because Baldwin manipulated it. That was the whole point to him having it. Of course he was going to manipulate it. It's foreseeable. Dummies look exactly like real bullets, but they don't sound exactly like real bullets. As you can tell from kind of that main image there, although this evidence dummy round has some writing on it, you wouldn't be able to distinguish that from a live bullet if you were just looking at it with your eyes. And because these dummy rounds are designed to look exactly like live ammunition, every round has to be thoroughly checked before it is put inside of one of these firearms. The OSHA finding that Rust Production failed to properly supervise Hannah Gutierrez is surprisingly incorrect because the armorer has no supervisor when it comes to weapons and gun safety on the movie set. Mr. Halls, David Halls, is just there to be a second pair of eyes. Keep in mind, the armorer has autonomy, So Gabrielle Pickle is not Hannah Gutierrez's boss when it comes to firearm safety. Ms. Gutierrez gets to do what she wants. Gutierrez Reed is the autonomous decision maker with regard to gun safety. Each of these statements made by Kerry Morrissey to this court as an officer of this court contradicts the premise of the state's jury instruction to the Baldwin grand jury and the theory of its case before the grand jury. It also highlights the extensive exculpatory evidence the state knew about but refused to present to the grand jury. Again, it's this argument that, well, if Gutierrez had liability, Baldwin can't. That's not the law. That's not rational. And Gutierrez having liability is not exculpatory for Baldwin. The state's expert, Carpenter, Brian Carpenter, the armorer expert, provides yet another example of evidence presented by the state at the Gutierrez trial that contradicted the state's presentation to the Baldwin grand jury. As explained in Baldwin's motion, Carpenter told the grand jury that Baldwin was responsible for gun safety and checking the weapon. I wonder where he might have gotten that idea. I wonder where Brian Carpenter got that idea, that the actor might be ultimately responsible for his own safety and the safety of fellow cast members. Maybe from the Screen Actors Guild? Yet he told the jury in Gutierrez Reed's trial that Gutierrez and Halls, not the actor, have the obligation to check and clear the gun. Well, SAG says production management and crew are responsible for creating and maintaining safe conditions, but it is the actor's right and responsibility to double check the setup to ensure your own safety. And of course, the safety of others. Let's see. I'm going to skip all these parenthetical quotes. The state's jury instruction violated the court's order, New Mexico law, the exculpatory information the state improperly refused to present, and the state's own factual representations at the Gutierrez trial. All of that's nonsense, as I've already explained. The indictment should therefore be dismissed on this separate ground. 4. The state admits its bad faith motives for pursuing an indictment. Baldwin's motion sets forth several examples of the state's bad faith conduct before and during the grand jury proceedings, including Morrissey's statements to the media that the purpose of the state's prosecution is to humble Baldwin because she finds him arrogant and wants to give him a teachable moment. Again, this is a claim made in a Hollywood media outlet by an anonymous source with no direct connection to Morrissey at all. There's no video, there's no recording, there's no named person. It's literally triple hearsay. Baldwin also details Morrissey's sanctionable conduct in connection with her violation of Judge Ellington's confidentiality order. This is Morrissey speaking to the media. Ellington had essentially ordered that people were not to speak to the media. The trouble for the defense position here is that the defense spoke to the media first. Baldwin gave that giant destructive interview to George Stephanopoulos. Once the defense does that, the state is allowed to respond, despite the judge's order. In response to Baldwin's motion, the state does not deny making these statements or disclaim the improper motives they reflect. Instead, it corroborates them. Well, it doesn't deny making the statements. It says, we made the statements. We were allowed to do that in response to your statements to the media. And it doesn't disclaim the improper motives. It doesn't say it had improper motives. What are they? Every time they say something, they're supposed to say, I make a statement and I disclaim improper motive for that statement. Instead, it corroborates them. The state's improper motives for prosecuting Baldwin are reflected. This is, again, like effectively, are reflected in special prosecutor's own words explaining her reasons for rescinding Baldwin's plea offer. On October 5th, 2023, the state offered Baldwin a very favorable plea agreement with the intention of ensuring that similarly situated defendants do not receive disparate treatment. According to the state, it seemed only fair to offer Baldwin the same deal that was offered 10 months earlier to David Halls, who told the state that he was the last line of defense to protect against this accident, and who testified at Gutierrez's trial that he accepted the plea deal because he was negligent in checking the gun properly before he handed it to Baldwin. But did he point the gun at Helena? Did Halls cock the hammer and pull the trigger with the muzzle pointed at Helena Hutchins? Who did that? That's Baldwin's independent criminal liability. The state gave Baldwin until October 27th to accept the plea offer. Yet the state withdrew the plea offer long before the deadline, shortly after Baldwin's attorneys contacted Morrissey to discuss the offer. The reason she withdrew it is because, just like the defense had gone to the media, gone to George Stephanopoulos, they also went to the media with this plea offer. And plea negotiations are supposed to be confidential between the parties. Otherwise, each side's just being extorted by the other. And the defense violated that obligation of confidentiality in plea negotiations. So Morrissey said, well, forget it. If you're not going to be acting in good faith, then we'll just take it off the table. We'll go to trial. You could have accepted the plea deal rather than go to the media with it. But you didn't do that, did you? Morrissey says she withdrew the offer because she believes Baldwin had commissioned his own documentary about Hutchins' death and sought to interview witnesses for the purported film. Well, that was one reason she gave, but you can have multiple reasons for an act, for a decision. As an initial matter, the information that ultimately prompted Morrissey to rescind the plea offer is inaccurate. As far as Baldwin is aware, what do you mean as far as he is aware? He's not aware. He doesn't know absolutely whether he's involved in a documentary on this event. Look at those weasel words. As far as Baldwin is aware, there are two documentaries currently being made about the Rust tragedy. The first is a documentary by Rachel Mason, which, according to news reports, has the full support of the Rust production. Well, Alec Baldwin's the Rust production. That's him. The full support of the Rust production and Hutchins' husband, who was involved as an executive producer. The second is a documentary by filmmaker Rory Kennedy. Baldwin has no ownership or financial stake in either documentary, but he's given them their full support. He's involved. He didn't hire Kennedy or commission her documentary. That's the second one. He has no title or credit in either documentary. He's not a producer and has no control of any kind over either documentary. But his company, Rust, the production, is providing the full support to the first documentary. In both documentaries, Baldwin is only a subject, along with other members of the cast and crew. Baldwin never commissioned a documentary about Rust or Hutchins' death. Morrissey's stated reason for rescinding Baldwin's plea offer is a completely inappropriate basis for prosecutorial action, and alone demonstrates her bad faith. That's in addition to the fact that her basis for withdrawing the plea offer long before the written deadline is not even true. Morrissey makes numerous other false statements in her brief about the events resulting in the dismissal of the case in April 2023 and leading up to her plea offer in October 2023. So the dismissal of the case was the first set of prosecutors who made some pretty bad missteps. And so they ended up resigning from the case, and their grand jury indictment was dismissed. So that's all moot. That's irrelevant. And after that, Morrissey was put on the case, and in October, she made a plea offer to Baldwin, which he ultimately didn't accept. For example, Morrissey falsely states that Baldwin's counsel said Harrison Ford and Helen Mirren would be testifying at the trial. Morrissey did make that claim in her motion. Baldwin's counsel never mentioned these actors in discussions with the state or said that they would be testifying. Well, that doesn't make Morrissey a liar. That's just a factual dispute. You think these defense lawyers would be willing to lie on behalf of their client here? I think they would. Morrissey's assertions about what Baldwin's counsel told NBC around the time of the plea offer are also false. As one of several examples, Baldwin first learned about the state's intended plea offer, as well as the state's decision to prosecute Baldwin instead of reinstating that offer, after the parties discussed it, not from the state, but from NBC, when it sought comment on those developments. So, It would be easy to go one by one through the rest of the state's inaccurate, unprofessional, and ad hominem attacks. Well, okay, why not? Add an appendix if it's so easy. And that's exactly what the state wants Baldwin to do, because the state's largely irrelevant brief is designed to defame Baldwin and his counsel, and therefore divert attention from the state's proven misconduct, proven to whose satisfaction, and inability to cite a single legal authority to support its position. Its legal authority is the New Mexico jury instruction for involuntary manslaughter. Morrissey's stated reasons for pursuing an indictment are completely divorced from the public interest and reflect a stunning abuse of prosecutorial power. Nope. What's the legal question in this case, folks? This, the jury instruction on involuntary manslaughter. Are there facts to satisfy this jury instruction? Absolutely. Baldwin's motion to dismiss demonstrates a litany of defects in the grand jury process, defects that were more severe and more numerous than we were able to locate in any single reported judicial decision in New Mexico. Deny the grand jury exculpatory evidence? Baldwin cites a decision justifying dismissal for that defect alone. Refuse to facilitate the grand jury's access to exculpatory evidence? Divert the grand jury from hearing testimony relevant to its explicit inquiries, and refuse to present exculpatory evidence that contradicted testimony from the prosecution's law enforcement witnesses. Baldwin cites cases that justify dismissal for each of those deficiencies. Read the grand jury an inaccurate legal instruction. Baldwin cites a separate case justifying dismissal for that too. Conduct the grand jury proceedings in a manner that renders them in fundamentally unfair. Baldwin has listed a mountain of misconduct by the state and authorities that justify dismissal. In addition to these and other unrebutted judicial decisions, Baldwin also cites several statutory provisions that justify dismissal. This is all nonsense. deny the grand jury exculpatory evidence. It's not exculpatory evidence appropriate for a grand jury unless it's relevant. It's not exculpatory evidence appropriate for a grand jury just because the defense says so. It has to be relevant exculpatory evidence. What David Halls, Sarah Zachary, Joel Souza feel about Baldwin's legal liability is irrelevant to the legal question in this case, as set out in the jury instruction. So perfectly appropriate to not provide that irrelevant quote-unquote exculpatory evidence to the grand jury. Refuse to facilitate the grand jury's access to exculpatory evidence. Same thing. Divert the grand jury from hearing testimony relevant to its explicit inquiries. Yes, the evidence would have been relevant to the grand juror's question, but the question was itself irrelevant to the legal issue in this case. And refuse to present exculpatory evidence that contradicted testimony from the prosecution's law enforcement witnesses. Again, defects in the investigation are not legally relevant. They don't go to any material fact in this case. Read the grand jury an inaccurate legal instruction. It's the New Mexico standard legal instruction with the blanks filled in, folks. That's all it was. conduct the grand jury proceedings in a manner that renders them fundamentally unfair. That's just an opinion by the defense. The state's response has remained constant since the first time the prosecutors went on a national media tour disparaging Baldwin and his lawyers. Defame and deflect. The state's failures to distinguish Baldwin's authorities, irrelevant authorities, cite any authorities of its own. They're not obliged to cite authorities to irrelevant arguments, or properly address the actual grounds for Baldwin's motion to dismiss, require that the indictment be dismissed. For the above reasons and the reasons set forth in his opening brief, Baldwin respectfully requests that the court dismiss the indictment. And that is it. So much ado about nothing, folks. Much ado about nothing. Now, I'm going to answer and address questions and comments first in the Law of Self-Defense Q&A. They, Law of Self-Defense members, get their questions and comments answered for free in the member Q&A on the member dashboard at lawofselfdefense.com. It's dirt cheap to be a Law of Self-Defense member. You can try it out for 2 weeks for just 99 cents at lawofselfdefense.com/trial. After that 2 weeks, it's still dirt cheap. It's only about 30 cents a day, less than $10 a month to be a Law of Self-Defense member, but at least try it out for 99 cents. The alternative to getting your questions and comments addressed is to make them a YouTube super chat of at least $10. So it's actually more for one question answered on YouTube than for an entire month of free questions answered as a Law of Self-Defense member. Choose wisely. All right, so let's take a look at what the Law of Self-Defense members have to say. One second. All right. Let's see. Just like only relevant evidence is appropriate for the grand jury, folks, only relevant questions and comments. So I can't read all of them unless they are relevant. Yeah, if Baldwin is convicted, this is Law of Self-Defense member Paul. He notes if Baldwin is convicted, he'll have 18 months of free security. Believe it or not, that's the maximum sentence he's looking at for a fourth-degree felony involuntary manslaughter under New Mexico law. After this shooting, New Mexico passed a gun sentencing enhancement law that would have made this a mandatory 5-year minimum. But criminal laws don't apply retroactively. That was one of the mistakes in the first indictment. They did indict him on that criminal statute, the gun sentencing enhancement, inappropriately so. And that's one of the reasons that grand jury indictment was dismissed. Yeah, Phil says, this defense brief sounds remarkably like nothing but the same dreary, factually irrelevant huffery and puffery that they put forward in their first brief. Yeah, but look at this list of lawyers here. Let's see, where is it? I'll just read them here. So in this motion for the defense, Heather LeBlanc is the local New Mexico attorney. You need to have a local person as kind of an anchor in the jurisdiction, someone licensed to practice law in New Mexico. That's her job here. It's I haven't seen her make any substantive legal argument in this case. That's being done by Luke Nikas and Alex Spiro from Quinn Emanuel Manhattan Law Firm. These guys might bill $1,000 an hour. Michael Nosenchuk, I think he's an associate, same law firm. Sarah Clark, I believe she's an associate, the same law firm. There's also a Jennifer Stern and a Stephanie Kellerman from Quinn Emanuel, also admitted pro hac vici. That just means you're not licensed to practice law in the jurisdiction, but the court's going to allow you to do it because you have that anchor attorney here. Each of those associates might be billing $500 an hour. It could be much more than that. It's been a long time since I've been involved in corporate practice, but so a lot of money's being spent on this defense, and Alec wants to see something for it. And what he's saying is these kinds of motions here. Let's see. Yep, Paul says they have to justify their huge fees somehow. Absolutely. By the way, the state has also added a prosecutor, another lawyer. Arinda Johnson, or Linda. E-R-L-I-N-D-A, Johnson, district attorney for Santa Fe. No, she's not the district attorney. Sorry. I'm trying to sum this up. By the way, I watched that first Hannah Gutierrez trial with Judge Marlowe, and she is a no-nonsense judge. I don't believe this histrionic whining by the defense is going to get anywhere. In fact, if I were Baldwin, if he were new enough to be worried about this, I'd be worried that it's creating a toxic environment between defense counsel and the trial judge. That shouldn't happen. But this stuff is really over the top by the defense. So here's that news story. New attorney joins prosecution team against Alec Baldwin in fatal Rust shooting. So it's not that Kerry Morrissey's going anywhere. They've just added a third attorney. For good reason, right? They're facing off against seven or eight attorneys who have all the time in the world to file nothing but a bunch of motions. And the state needs the resources to respond. This was done in reverse, by the way, in the Derek Chauvin trial. So there were because it was so politically energized, there was a whole bunch of lawyers who wanted to raise their profile in the legal community and political community that got admitted pro hac vici in the Derek Chauvin trial from outside the jurisdiction. I think the state ended up with 12 or 13 attorneys on the state side against Derek Chauvin, one attorney on the defense side. And they ran that defense attorney to exhaustion because they were filing motions like every night that the defense had to respond to. And so here's this one defense attorney in court all day, which is extremely stressful. And then he's up, half the night reading and responding to these tons of motions by the state. It's a tactic used to exhaust the opposition. And and that can happen here in reverse with the defense having seven or eight lawyers and the state having only two. So now the state has three. An attorney has been added to the special prosecution team that is pursuing an involuntary manslaughter charge against Alec Baldwin in the fatal shooting of a cinematographer on the set of Western movie Rust. The district attorney for Santa Fe has appointed Erlinda Johnson as special prosecutor to the case, which is scheduled for trial in July. I believe. Let me just double check the date there. I do plan to live stream that trial, by the way. Jury selection on July 9th. And the trial scheduled to start July 10th. So the judge is only planning on one day for jury selection. We'll see. We will see. Baldwin's pleaded not guilty to involuntary manslaughter in the shooting of Helena Hutchins during an October 2021 rehearsal, blah, 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 blah. Let's see. Hear more about Johnson. Erlinda Johnson's experience as a criminal defense and personal injury attorney include representing former New Mexico State Secretary of State Diana Duran, who resigned in 2015 amid revelations she used campaign funds to fuel a gambling addiction. Duran received a 30-day jail sentence after pleading guilty to embezzlement and money laundering charges. Johnson previously worked as a federal prosecutor on drug enforcement and organized crime investigations after serving as assistant DA in the Albuquerque area. So she's a prosecutor who hung up a prosecutor's hat and went over to the defense side. And now she's been, I'm sure, Kerry Morrissey personally selected her for this honor of being involved in this case. By the way, I have seen that video of Alec Baldwin in the coffee shop in New York with that heckler. I don't think I'm going to cover it. It's obviously the heckler is a piece of trash, whatever you think of Alec Baldwin. And I don't know that he did anything to her. Or she's just making it look like maybe he smacked her phone out of the way or something. It's obviously a created for clicks event. Let's see. Texas says, law self-defense member, when your client gives you nothing but feelings and other non-relevant BS, I suppose your only route is a shotgun approach. Shoot all the crap you can and hope somehow some of it might stick. The downside is you've already thrown all the Hail Marys possible. I don't know how I would defend Baldwin in this case, given the incontroverted facts. I don't think he has a legal defense. If it were me and I was his defense counsel, I would have grabbed that David Hall plea deal with both hands. Misdemeanor, 6 months, unsupervised release. Come on. No, these big shot Manhattan lawyers just puffed themselves up in front of Baldwin and said, don't worry about it, man. We got your back. We can walk all over these podunk New Mexico First Judicial District lawyers. They can't stand up to us. Look at this. My suit costs more than that woman makes in a year. Maybe. But lawyers are stuck with the facts you give them, and Baldwin gave his lawyer terrible facts. Yeah, David says, if you have the law on your side, pound the law. If you have the facts on your side, pound the facts. If you have neither law nor facts on your side, pound the table. That is the legal cliche. I don't know what penitentiary he might go to. I don't know if he'll qualify for minimum security. Remember, the judge just sentenced Hannah Gutierrez and classified her as a violent offender so that she'd have to do 85% of her 18 months instead of the 50% she might have been eligible for with time off or good behavior. I don't know if you go to a minimal security facility if you've been classified as a violent offender. I mean, don't get me wrong. Sentencing is not my area of expertise, but I would have to worry about that. Now, of course, one of the reasons, and hopefully Alec would learn from this, but given his apparent personality, who knows? One of the reasons Gutierrez was classified as a violent offender was she just showed absolutely no remorse in any of her prison communications, and the judge saw all of that. She was pissed. She was insulting the judge, insulting everybody. It was zero accountability. Kyle says, is there a point that these baseless accusations become sanctionable? Not really in court filings. Can the judge do any sanctions to these New York attorneys outside of a verbal slap on the hands for all the relevant arguments? You know, I don't know. But I would assume when you're admitted pro hac vici, which I've never done, but I assume that when you're admitted pro hac vici, it's contingent on you being subject to whatever, you know, a local attorney would be subject to in terms of discipline. No judge wants an uncontrollable lawyer in their courtroom. That would be terrible. There has to be the possibility for sanctions. Let's see. Jeffrey asks, since these filings are going to a judge and they are using irrelevant arguments, could the defense be hoping the media picks it up in order to make an emotional appeal to the public, potential jurors? Sure. I mean, look, they may be telling Baldwin to give more credit here. They may be telling Baldwin, listen, you're screwed. You're screwed. Between what you did and those interviews you gave, you're completely out of luck. You're going to get, if they want to convict you of involuntary manslaughter, and apparently they do, they took the plea deal away, you're going to get convicted. So we have to become more strategic than a straightforward trying for an acquittal. Acquittal's off the table. Absent a completely insane jury. What we should be doing now is laying the groundwork so that when you're convicted, we can characterize that conviction as fundamentally unjust. That could be what they're doing here. Hot Lips Hancock. Yeah, Hooters Hancock. Detective Alexandra Hancock will be back on the witness stand. Let's see. I don't think any of this nonsense is going to work in the courtroom. Any of this defense nonsense. Not with this judge and this prosecutor. Kerry Morrissey is a very smart lawyer. Let's see. Bup, 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 bup. Yeah, so when I talked about Hannah Gutierrez getting the violent offender classification, so she'd have to do 85% of her sentence instead of 50%, I hope Baldwin learns from that. I mean, certainly if he gets convicted, you know, the guilt phase of the trial's over, you go into sentencing, you better be as remorseful as possible. But I don't know. He has so many statements in those interviews. You know, I know it's somebody's fault. It's just not mine. Let's see. Does a judge, in terms of evidence, does a judge allow anything and expect a jury to filter out in terms of the instructions? He's asking about relevance here. No, all the evidence, every bit of evidence to be presented by the jury will be disclosed between the parties first. Either party can make an objection based on relevance, that the evidence offered is irrelevant. And then they argue it in front of the judge, and the judge decides whether to admit it into evidence. That all happens outside the hearing of the jury. Bup, bup, bup. Denver says, even my very young teen knew how to and the importance of clearing a firearm when handed to him. Yes, when the gun touches your hand, the first thing you do is clear it. First thing. And if you don't know how, you don't handle the gun. Just hand, you know, say, no thanks. I'm not familiar with the manual of arms on this or whatever. Ideally, the gun should be handed over with the action open, right? The bolt open, whatever. The slide back, no magazine in the gun. But a lot of people don't know to do that. So you can't control what other people do, right? How they're handing you the gun. And if they don't know how to do that, I don't want to tell them to do that. Then they may try and screw it up. So if they're going to be handing me a gun and the slide's forward and the mag's in, I'm just going to take it and take the mag out and work the slide. Kent asks, with the Baldwin in the coffee shop, was he privileged to slap the phone out of her hand? Well, he's privileged to move her out of the way if she's blocking his exit from the coffee shop. Maybe that incidentally knocked the phone out of her hand. I don't even know if that's true. You know, he could have been just slipping by her and she throws her own phone on the floor to make it look like that happened. I mean, she probably got a million clicks from that. She's a known provocateur of this type. It's not just a normal citizen. Yeah, I don't know exactly what happened in that case, folks. I've only seen the little bit of video from her phone, and it doesn't show everything. All right, let's take a look and see if there's any super chats. Hopefully not. Hopefully everyone's doing the smart thing and becoming a law of self-defense member, or at least getting a free copy of our book, The Law of Self-Defense Principles. Check it out on Amazon. Great reviews, 5-star rated, bestseller in its category, but don't buy it on Amazon. They'll charge you for the book and shipping and handling. We only ask you to cover the cost of shipping the book to you. This is your handbook on how to be hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, or property. But don't read the book afterwards. read the book before the fight so you know what to do and what not to do. Again, you can get this for free at lawofselfdefense.com/freebook. Free book. All right. Earn. Let's see. Super chats. No new super chats. Last take a look at. let's see. Yeah, hopefully somebody will get to judge a hairbrush. I thought that Judge Marlo was great, by the way, in the Hannah trial, and I have great expectations for her in this one as well. All right. With that done, folks, I will wrap up the show 2 hours and 15 minutes. Good Lord. Thank you all. 1,000. Oh, by the way, if you're on YouTube, if you could subscribe, that would be great. That's free. Some of you watching on mobile on YouTube, I think you can only subscribe and give a thumbs up as you're exiting the show. So if you're starting to exit, hit that subscribe button. Maybe you'll get notifications. You never know with YouTube. Hit that thumbs up like button. That's always greatly appreciated. Thank you all so much. And I'll just remind all of you that if you carry a gun, so you're hard to kill, or you carry a knife, or you carry pepper spray, or you study jujitsu, I do all those things. So I'm hard to kill. So my family is hard to kill. If you do any of that, so you're hard to kill, so your family is hard to kill, then you also owe it to yourself and your family to make sure you know the law, so you're hard to convict as well. Until next time, I remain Attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.